So I'm just going to introduce George. Now, if I look at the description we put on the flyer, just read that out. George Galdis is a native of Izmir.
Should I be standing?
No, you can sit, it may take slightly longer. George moved to the UK in 1974, having resigned as British Vice Consul to start a new career in international trade. In his retirement, he has been actively seeking to keep alive the memory of Levantine Smyrna through writings and gatherings. He is a life member of our foundation. Now, I think that's a pretty miserly description of George's contribution. I just want to go back a bit and talk about how we got started. So it started first with Craig there,
yes,
who created the website where people assembled, or Craig assembled, their testimonials, stories about their families and their Levantine connections, also a vast amount of other material. And there you can see all these testimonials of the families, and a lot of people use the website for their research. There's lists of references, papers, all our events, videos, let you browse. But what actually got us from Craig's website to the Levantine Heritage Foundation? So actually it was a conference that George and Alex Baltazzi organised in 2010 in Izmir with the sponsorship of the Izmir Chamber of Commerce, where we had, was it over 100 delegates?
Yes.
So a full day and then entertainment and so on, and a tour, or several tours, in subsequent days, subsequent 2 days, to sites of interest, so cemeteries and other places, even somewhere to Ephesus, I think.
Indeed, yeah.
And it was such a success. Now, why? But partly because a lot of the delegates were Levantine descendants, family researchers, but also academics who were interested in the field. And if you like, our differentiation as an organisation is that we're a hybrid organisation. So the family researchers can get the context from the academics who've done the research. The academics can sometimes tap into original material that is not otherwise available. And we, largely through Craig, broker some of those interactions. So as a friend or member of the LHF, if we're doing research, we are very happy to use our network to introduce you to people, whether you're an academic or you're a private researcher. So, great success. Thanks. Thank you, George, and thank you to the late, great Alex Baltazzi. We said, well, look, we've got to let this continue and grow. So we set up the foundation, and in the sort of 12 years that have passed, George has been a constant contributor in many ways, and you know, his description here, he understates what he has done. I'd like to refer to the Smyrnaica lexicon, I think compiled with Alex and also George Boulimenes. Yes. So a really substantial contribution, and you know, if you need to find out something about a family or Izmir, then it's always good to go to George because he knows.
I have about 4 copies available.
Ah, and you're a great salesman as well. So I just want to say thank you, George. You have well deserved your life membership of the NHF. And I'm absolutely delighted that we have an opportunity to learn more through his talk tonight and through his book, which is, if you like, an expanded testimonial of the LHF type. It's almost an encyclopedia of things Levantine, characteristics of Levantines. So I'm going to stop there. Lastly, I just want to introduce Philip Mansell, who is going to chair our session and manage the questions and answers afterwards. I very much hope you enjoy the evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are we going to enter?
Oh, I'll do it.
Right. This is a very quick introduction. You can see I'm saying thank you to Hellenic Center and the Hellenic Foundation. In case I forget, I must say that without Crave, we would not have achieved where we are today. Craig's hard work and continuous hard work is really what is keeping this foundation going day to day. And we receive inquiries almost every month. There's an inquiry coming from anywhere in the world, people wanting to know something or quoting their ancestors. So very briefly, we'll look at it. For those who are, for the uninitiated, if you like, what Anatolia was, and also I will touch, because it's in the book, how Izmir was rebuilt in a very, very quick sort of sequence after the fire, and I will quote a few passages from the book, especially there's quite a story of my father's, of how he escaped the fire with his family and so on. So there we are. As Quentin said, it all started in 2010 with this Smirnaker lexicon, and as I was reading it, I said, all these words remind me of something, and this is remind me of my childhood. So I think I'm going, rather than going chronologically, I will just go alphabetically and name the words that have made my childhood and later life. So I started writing the book, and I didn't know what to do as a book cover. This is a photograph of a runner in our house in the wintertime, which reminds me of what's really dealt soon. Why this runner? Because it's a keepsake carpet. It invokes and synthesizes the memories of our multi-ethnic, multi-confessional childhood. The motifs and the motifs and colors within, the blood red, the cover pictures symbolize the dynamism of the Aegean region, but also, for me, it signifies the, reminds us of the blood spilled through the millennial struggle between inhabitants of Asia Minor and the invaders of Asia Minor. This happened through millennia and thousands of years. But it's not negative, because each wave of cultures that came through to Asia Minor have contributed to enriching Anatolia. Just to remind ourselves that after the conquest of Constantinople... Hello, Ellen, come in. I was just saying that after the conquest of Constantinople, the Byzantines had lost the power, and the Ottoman Turks became effectively ex officio the Eastern Roman Empire. But also in the Mediterranean, Italian maritime republics were becoming the main trading forces ever since they had ventured out on the 13th century crusades. This is not my field of study. There's people like George Vassialis, Dr. Vassialis, who's here tonight, who is an expert in these fields. But I want to say that by the 16th century, the Ottomans had signed treaties called capitulations with the European powers, granting them concessions, once they failed to see that their own empire was fraying at the seams. This is the extent of the Ottoman Empire in 1683. As we know, this is a huge spread. I'm sorry, I got one slide back. So the Ottoman capitulations meant that immigrants from foreign powers, including citizens of colonies and empires such as the British Empire, its newly acquired territories of Malta, the Ionian Islands and Cyprus. My own family dates back to those days, when Malta had been saved by the Royal Navy and became effectively British, a British territory. Maltese ancestors took advantage of the British presence in Turkey under these capitulations and moved to Smyrna. That's the consular registration on the right of Marino Galdis. And you can see his progenitude, his sisters, his brothers, quite large families. That was the case in those days. So a maritime map of Smyrna of 1882 shows where the castle at the top end, right hand side, is where the Turks and the Turkish forces pass themselves. Welcome, Daron. Can you see the other seats over there?
Yes, definitely.
And the Europeans were naturally based along the sea shore. With one arrow shows the British consulate, the bottom arrow. There's even the right-hand side arrow shows the British military cemetery. So they set up home, basically, in Smyrna at that time. Now here, I'll start in the alphabetical order. Letter A means Alsancak, which is the modern name for that quarter of Smyrna, which was called Punta or La Fuente when the Europeans started expanding. Smyrna itself can date its history to the 1450s BC, but our story is the 15th century AD, when the tribe of Osman triumphed over all other lords of the Turks, and one of his generals settled on Mount Tigris, which was the highest point of the city. And he took hold of the Genoese castle that was there and is still standing. So the Turks also grew in population and started coming towards the sea, whilst the Europeans all congregated towards the point. But for us, the people of Smyrna, Alsancak is basically where the majority of the Italian, Maltese, French, Dutch, and many of the English population live. In this story, I will introduce you to my family. So we see my father on the left, Peter. Then he was baptized Peter Polycarp after the Saint Polycarp of Smyrna. My brother Paul Winston, my paternal grandmother, my mother. That's me. Just about my head can be seen in the middle of the table there. My uncle Anthony and my step grandmother Alexandra, who was born a Fennec, and Georgia Gulina on the right hand side. My paternal grandfather is hanging on the wall above the scene. And under letter B, there are lots of entries under each letter, so we're not going to bore everyone with every single one. When you read the book, you will find that you discover some quite exciting things about it. But people ask me sometimes, how come you're a British subject, having been born in Turkey? So British subject by birth was what I was given when I was born. British subjects by birth derive their nationality by virtue of one parent or grandparent or ancestor having been born on a British territory. For me, it was Smyrna, because my ancestors were born in Malta. But there were others whose ancestry was Cyprus, and of course the Anglo-Saxons, if you like, of Smyrna were born or had ancestors born in Great Britain and Ireland. And so we lived in Turkey. We were obliged to carry a foreigner's residence permit, and although we had been there in three or four generations, we still were considered as foreigners. There are several factors that affected my childhood and my father's childhood. I highlighted the main things is that he was affected by the 1920s, and that runs in several pages from 83 to 118, the fleeing from Smyrna to Malta and the return to Smyrna. He was cosmopolitan, he was Christian, and above all, he was still a British patriot, although he was never born in Britain. He had experienced two major military wars, occupation and the War of Independence, that is the War of Independence of Turkey, or of the Ottoman Empire becoming Turkey. He witnessed the abolition of the capitulations and the Treaty of Lausanne. As for me, I was born in cosmopolitan city, Christian, British patriot. I witnessed the rebirth of Smyrna as Izmir. I witnessed the end of major military wars, although the Cold War was there. And I discovered a career very early in my teens. I speak about my schooling, or lack of, or mediocrity in schooling. I also witnessed the devastation that was still prevailing in town, the dawn of the Cold War, and the final demise of the capitulations, as we lost all of the capitulation rights. So under letter S, again, like several pages, letter S for me is Sefer Beylik, which Sefer Beylik in Turkish means mobilization or state of war. Turkey's entry into World War I is known to us by the Battle of the Dardanelles, by the British Navy and the French. But this victory of the Young Turks, because that victory was initiated by Atatürk and other Young Turks, also signaled the doom of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Emperor was on his way out. The writer David Woodward describes in a book, Searching for Peace, Britain got itself into the war with the Ottoman Empire. It seems that the Turks were open to accept the £4 million of the day from the British, should the British also give a firm guarantee that once the Anglo-Prussian War was over, that Constantinople would remain Turkish. But it was not to be. London would not risk that Russia should take control of Constantinople. In it, I mention also Frederick Edwin Whittle of Smyrna was a leading member of the negotiating team. Smyrna, during the First World War, my father wrote this chapter, What I Remember of the War, that's the 1418 War. And he tells us, my father was taken by the Ottomans as hostage of war. We were left to life without a breadwinner. During the time, his father was an internee. We had much difficulty in finding provisions, especially bread. It must have been five. But still, my father's speaking. He says that no foreign schools were open. There were the Allied power ones that were state-run had disappeared. And the only free-of-charge foreign schools remaining had religious instructors and management. In fact, they were not exactly free-of-charge because they still had to pay some fees to the priests running these schools. He had to pay fortnight visits to his father at his place of internment, which was Mount Tigris, the Citadel, all from time to time they had to move, to be moved to other locations. The first morning of the first day at the Greek Orthodox school, this was the worst thing that could have happened in my judgment of that age and circumstances. He goes through describing how he absolutely hated going to the Greek Orthodox school and being scared with the long bearded Orthodox priests and their top hats or whatever they are called. That's quite a funny little sequence there. So it says it did not take too long to understand that one day, that was the Armistice Day, he heard shouts of joy everywhere, and it did not take too long to understand that an Allied ship had entered the harbor, and this meant that the hostilities were off and an armistice was signed. I say, effectively, under the Mudros Turkish Ottoman, under the Mudros Treaty, Turkish Ottoman regions were allocated to the victorious British and French. And they were to rule Constantinople and the Levant, i.e. Syria and Iraq, and a few other Arab provinces, whereas Greece had a sway of the Aegean, including Smyrna. But this victory was to be short-lived. The nationalist Turkish army of Kemal Atatürk was already mooting his revolution and war of independence. My father continues, I was almost 7 years old when I lost my father. He was born in 1871. My mother was left a widow at the age of 41, born 1878. She did not accept much from her own father because she had married my father, that's my grandfather, who was a Catholic. So her father was not very pleased, as it was in those days for an Orthodox girl to marry a Catholic or vice versa. So she was left basically penniless with not much help from anyone. She started to mend our clothes and also to look for what could be salvaged from my father's suits and shirts, which could be used for me later on. He follows this with narratives of 2 years of occupation by the Greek army. He mentions the Kuzineri Park being turned into a Greek army camp, and my father and his friends watching them carry out the military drills. As he was growing up, he had resumed working part-time in his maternal uncle's cobbler's shop, so they did give him a job. Every Wednesday, they invited him to lunch with his Greek aunts, Dimitria and Irene. He continues, it was springtime. They were expecting to see the arrival of and landing of the Greek troops coming to occupy Smyrna and the suburbs. So they went and watched them land and so on. The Greek army began to integrate local non-Muslims, the rayas, that's people without nationality, into the national Greek army. But Armenians, Jews, and even local Greeks who were stateless left the country and emigrated to the United States, France, Australia, etc., for the sole reason that not to serve in the occupation army and be sent to the front line. Basically, they were scared of going and getting killed. It's right to say that life was much better than during the First World War and the War of Independence. So, at the beginning of the month of August, the Turks were now fighting the War of Independence. In August 1922, one morning, we saw soldiers of the Red Cross carrying the Red Cross badges, carrying stretchers with wounded militaries from the military hospital to the ships. Masses of women and children, refugees from Anatolia. My father's sisters, Mary and Elizabeth, were busy fixing a Union Jack on a bamboo cane mast over the front door, hoping that this was going to save them and the house. But then they were told that they had to evacuate. They got official papers and everything that they needed to prove their identity and the little money. My grandmother placed this in a tin box and bound it around her waistband. There was nowhere else to go. That was the last part of land. In front was the sea, and behind the immense land of Anatolia, which land they would never have to see again. Such was the destiny of these unfortunate people who for centuries had struggled, mingled with various creeds and nationalities, lived next to each other, intermarried, had freedom of religion and customs, but because some political mistakes by unworthy politicians, as he says, of the allied nations, jealous of each other, abandoned this rich land with historic monuments and its Christian inhabitants to the mercy of the Asian invading powers that obliged millions of innocent Greeks and Armenian people be either killed or drowned in the sea or beautiful Gulf. To this invading power, Asian powers, it was not only the Turks, the Turkish army, but it was armies from Iran and elsewhere that were arriving for the liberation of the Aegean. I was lucky enough to acquire this postcard of the British consulate, which features in his accounts how they were gathered in this area that you see here in the postcard prior to being evacuated onto the ships. And on the left there is a painting by Ovid Kurtovich of the fire of Smyrna as it was watched from one of the evacuating ships. He goes on to describe how they were evacuated. The cargo ship Barbaria was unloading coal and was ordered to stop unloading and be ready to receive the British evacuees. Smoke and ashes started to fall on the decks of the ships. Cries and shouts of people now started jumping into the sea, trying to swim for safety towards the various ships anchoring in the bay. There were now more people in the sea than ashore, many floating drowned. And then there are several pages where he describes the evacuation, their sea journey to Malta, quarantine in the Lazaretto, which is a quarantine hospital in Malta, their life there as war refugees, their schooling and First Communion, letters from Smyrna that started arriving through the Red Cross, telling of the destruction of their homes. And then eventually they decided, rather than come, either they had the choice to return to Smyrna, stay in Malta and be paupers, or come to London. A good deal of the Galdices came back to England, and from here they emigrated to Australia, where many of them live. Some moved to Wales, but we lost complete track of them. But, so they request the family of George Carolina, my maternal grandfather, if they could take my father's sister to travel with them. And on this trip, George Carolina's daughter Mary, my mother, was to become his wife one day, but he did not know that at the time, as they were both in maybe 10 years old. He concludes, dropping of anchors from the Theodosia made us realize that we were now in the anchorage area for disembarkation and had to prepare ourselves to face the masters of the country. He means the new masters of the country, and to a large extent of our own future destiny. And I have a little collage in the book of photographs of Smyrna in the ruins as they arrived back from Malta to Smyrna. I had this under K for Kamena. Kamena means the burnt lands, which is what they found. The wasteland which resulted from the fire. The 1930s photo was taken, my father had taken, that's in the 1930s, as I said, on the ruins of what was left of the Greek Orthodox Church of St. John the Baptist. The previous maps that we saw at the beginning showed where the St. John the Baptist Church was located. It was one of the first churches to be built, Orthodox churches to be built in Sparta. The roof houses that you see at the back is the line where the fire stopped. Also seen are the remaining scattered rubble of the ruins. And by the way, this remained so until the 1950s, and I remember, and I mention all this very clearly in the book, how we used to go, and my cousin George is here, he will remember how we used to take our lambs before before Easter on the, in the wasteland where the grass, and to give them to them, and fatten them for our Easter.
And lunch. The kites.
Yes.
And the kites.
And fly the cats. Yeah. It's all in the book. So the above photo below, when I try to enlarge it, you will see the line of houses are brought forward a bit. Right at the back is the campanile of the Dominican Church, the Italian Dominican Church. And then there's a row of houses in front. Those, in fact, are shanty towns, shanty houses that the municipality, the new Turkish municipality, allowed them to build, as there was a serious shortage of houses. Most of the town had been burnt down. Our Aikolina grandfather's side was lucky because his house was three houses away from the Anglican church and the English quarter, which was spared because the Turks would not want to touch them and us for trouble. And so he goes on pages 199 to 230. He describes the return voyage from Malta, how he encounters this advocate housing shortage, and how he had to go and look for menial work in order to contribute to housekeeping. And he was still quite young. And there are several sequences. One is that he worked at the only undertakers, and how they were, how they had to carry the coffins on the back of horse-driven carriages in the mud, quite medieval in many ways. But he's not complaining. He's a rather amusing slant to it, if you like. And then he ends his account in his account of the early 30s, where he had secured himself a promising career eventually, having worked at the banks and through connections at the banks, was able to find one of the largest Italian companies and opened himself a promising career. He also discovered a passion for gun sports. Mm-hmm. The Levantines in Smyrna all loved to go shooting. They went shooting birds or boar or rabbits, but that was not for mere pleasure. It was also where they would get the best proteins rather than rely on butchers who were more or less non-existent. It's ironic because my grandfather, George Aikolina's grandfather, was a butcher. And he knew all about butchery, but there was no meat to be had in order to go butchering. So the whole community went shooting. So my father discovered his passion, and like with everything else, he gave all his attention to gun sports and produced his own cartridges and so on.
And he was very good at it too.
Yes. And acquired a gun dog named Norma. And he also found enough time to go courting my mother, much to the dismay of her father. But that's another story. And World War II was soon to arrive, and with it, my brother Paul Winston arrived. So So that ends, if you like, my father's story, and I start my own little story here. I had gone to the French nuns or sisters' kindergarten. I'm sure Joyce Saliba here, the two Saliba sisters, you would have gone also to the same nursery. And the time came for me to attend education proper at the French brothers, Christian brothers, at the Frères. Now the whole family was rejoicing on me going to school, but I had no desire to go to school. I discovered that my beautiful long curls were much admired by the grown-ups. And the prospect of losing them did not enthral me, because I would lose all the cuddles and being spoiled. So, but to the barber I was taken, and I recount my experiences at the barber. That's me sitting on our first car, which was a Topolino, the first Fiat 500. My father was able to get this because the company he was working for were agents for Fiat. And so, we have to remember something now about my childhood. We have to remember the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We went to events that shaped and are still shaping our world today. There were several things happening. The fascists and the Marxists and the communists and so on. The relatively new and possibly still frail Turkish Republic, which had now newly joined the NATO alliance, was once again occupying an important role. And Turkey was a key actor now in the world theater. Our Western countries were vying for Turkey's attention. Turkey's inhabitants were rich, but their gold was kept literally under the mattress. These hitherto semi-tribal peasant instincts were inhibiting investment. Usually it was still a religious taboo for the Muslims. There was a general fear that the country might split into groups of national socialists versus others who were keen to open up to foreign investors. And that went on, with governments falling, martial law starting, and so on. One saving thing for us in Smyrna was the International Fair of Izmir, which is under F or Foi in French. In this fair, we used to have national days when ambassadors would come down from Ankara and they would try to surpass each other with hospitality. And for somebody who was getting summer jobs in this fair, we used to have a non-ending festival of international cuisine, night after night, for the 1 month when this fair used to run. We had the visit of Vice President Lyndon Johnson. I was at the American pavilion that day, and I saw him close by, and I did not like the man. There was something that did not click with him. Anyway, Smyrna had market gardens, and in the watermelon season there was a huge market which was occupying some of the wasteland that you saw in the previous pictures, where the Greek Orthodox Church had been located. They used to establish this watermelon market. The church itself used to be called St. John of the Cherry Orchard, Ayusianis to Keratohor. And the French used to call it Les Jardins de Smyrne to the east, and the Skinavica, the rope makers, to the west, towards the sea. My paternal grandfather's cottage and small holding was southeast of it, very near the Cusinary Gardens. That's why my father used to see the Greek army train in there during the occupation. I have other pages, in pages 149, about mandarins, a nice story, when George and Hélène and and my brother and I used to go to Behçet Bey's gardens, yes, and gorge ourselves on mandarins. I speak about the olive trees we used to have in our own farms. Very important for us in Middle East was the apartamento. Apartamento is apartment buildings. Up to now, up to 1950s, we used to be able to see Mount Pagos, as you will see in a picture that follows. We have unlimited views over the whole of the plain of Smyrna. But one day we saw diggers arrive and fill our field of vision. Foundations were being cut in the empty fields, what we call Takamena. New boulevards were being laid. New neighborhoods were emerging. Turkish professionals and civil servants whose families had been uprooted from the Balkans and Crete were coming. And add to this a sprinkling of Salonician Jews who fleeing the Nazi occupation of Greece had gone seeking refuge in Turkey, also having previously converted to Islam, some of them. So this is it. I've circled Mount Pagus on the top picture, and if you follow the arrow down to where it says my bedroom, I don't know if you can follow that with the blue arrow. This is the view. The top picture is the view we used to have uninterrupted, and then suddenly the bottom picture, we see these apartment buildings being raised. So that, we were a bit miffed about that, but that was life. Under D, that's also an important word, druba. Druba is a hand-operated water pump. When lead pipes were made illegal or discontinued, up to then we used to pump water from natural aquifers about 30 meters below. But then it was made illegal, so our table water was purchased in glass bottles from the Turkish Green Crescent Society from the springs of Afyonkarahisar. Now, the city of Afyonkarahisar and the city of Afyon, I mentioned elsewhere in the book, was an important city for the Aegean, because Afyonkarahisar and that area used to produce most of the poppy, the opium poppy, which was exported, one of the main exports from Smyrna. But this is also where the Greek army of occupation stopped during the First World War. And I could hear adults recount the many atrocities and massacres that had happened from both sides. Greek soldiers and Ottoman nationals, indigenous Orthodox Greeks who had escaped the carnage, found themselves driven towards the Aegean Sea, where they found the city of Smyrna on fire. These scenes are narrated by Giles Milton in Paradise Lost. Many of you would have read. My mother tongue, my received language was Spanish Greek, and it's a written form, we called it Fragiotica, meaning it's Greek but written in Latin characters. And therefore, as elsewhere in Asia Minor and Anatolia, there were people spoke Greek, but we spoke Spionika Greek in Smyrna and Politica in Constantinople. And called Politica Greek. Because Polis, Politica, this is where Constantinople is the city. We also spoke French, and I eventually learned Italian from speaking to Italian neighbors, children playing with them, and American children playing, because thanks to NATO we had quite a large American community as well. But my Turkish was lagging. That was because I had little opportunity to mingle with Turkish children. There weren't that many, or there were the few that were. The parents were not all that keen that they should mix with us and vice versa. But my father by then had acquired a farm, so I used to spend quite a lot of time on the farm and speak Turkish with the farm hands, etc. We also used to travel quite a bit in Asia Minor and visit Istanbul, and there are several passages where I relate to our visit to Istanbul. My grandmother, my father's mother, would come, and then he would come with us, and she would love to visit the Hagia Sophia, and she used to call Anatolia and the Levant in general Tayyia Hamata, the holy soils. And in Ataturk, in modern Turkish, used to call Turkey Kutsal Toprak. Well, very quickly, my ancestors, A for Ekulina, this is George Ekulina, who was the seventh child of Lucas Ekulina. He was a Maltese stevedore who was born in Smyrna in 1852. And there is George Ekulina standing in front of his grocer's shop. And I have, unfortunately, my highlight did not work on this ancient computer. So the yellow blob you see there was highlighting the canary cage, and the other on the left, but it's very clear in the book, he had a gas lamp. I made some quite a thorough research and found that the Haikulinas had arrived to Malta from Spain, like, as with scores of other Catalan Aragonese immigrants and soldiers, which was to repel the invading Ottoman forces into Malta, the famous siege of Malta. As for the galleys, this is rubbish. The galleys were Caldes, and I also found that the family originated from the water springs of Malavella in Catalonia, and the surname is listed in many Spanish archives. But most of the Caldes had daughters, therefore the surname Caldes is called quite rare these days in Spain. But it's Caldes with an accent on it. But there used to be a Castel de Caldes, plus elsewhere in the book I show you also the Caldes house in Barcelona, which is now part of the Picasso Museum. And so, Punta or Alsajar, the Punta station, this is our British-built station, and there was a huge row of houses opposite it which housed the English community that did not live in the suburbs of Bornova. The reason I put this is because, as I mentioned, that the wasteland, the northeastern side of the station, was cleared. The football station replaced the Orthodox cemetery, which was previously built on a land that was going to become the Panionios Stadium. So the Turks, when they took possession of the city, they built the Altay Stadium, and which was demolished a few years ago, and they discovered quite a lot of tombstones and fragments and so on. So some of my ancestry is buried there. The Greek ancestry was buried there. And there we go. In 1965, we moved out of our paternal house. As we closed down the Consulate General, the British Consulate General was closed down on the waterfront, and my father took over because he, although he wasn't all that keen to take me over, he did it because he felt that we still had a good British and Maltese community that needed to have some representation. So he volunteered to be the first honorary British consul, and we moved the office into that. I have, just to give you an idea of what Smyrna used to be in the 19th century, are the two bottom photographs there. the photo on the left is of sort of lower income families. The photo on the right was middle class, used to live in these lovely old houses. And the photograph above shows you how the high rise was gradually and gradually replacing all the waterfront villas that had been built there by the rich of the town. So our houses had under the letter A, Biavli. That was the whole of the original 17 houses, which also doubled up as dance floor for parties, and we had many of those, especially during the carnival season, the carnival of Smyrna. There are some people in that photograph, that some of people who will acquire the book will recognize those characters. The English and Anglican community mostly lived in the suburb of Bornova, and I used to go there to learn English and do my English classes. And we have the Giraud house on the left and the Wilkinson house on the right. Another suburb was the suburb of Buja, which was even older than Bornova, and this is where Francis Wherry arrived to visit his father that he had not seen ever since they had put him in boarding school there. His father was the first Levant Company consul in 1793, a friend of Admiral Nelson. I gave a chapter on the lovely afternoon teas we used to have in Smyrna. This one is at the house of the Messieurs in Buja. Why Messieurs? Because Livio Messier was the 17th EU commissioner in Brussels, and Livio was a very good friend of the family, and we were in correspondence until he passed away. And there are a little sea of I put Cheshme, because it was a great summer resort where I would go for my summer breaks to spend with my cousin, Ukrainian cousins. And there's a photograph of my auntie Anne, cousin Hélène, little cousin George, little George. You wouldn't believe it when you see the size of him. And myself. And an interesting side of on my father's side, his sister Maria had married a consul. Vittorio Consolo was quite a character. He used to play truant from school and spend time in his uncle's hotel in the kitchens and learning all the secrets of a good internationally known hotels, which was the Hotel de la Ville, and he belonged to that family. Fra Giacomo's was some Fra Giacomo's still exist in Smyrna, but they are in New York, and some of them are in Athens. So I give a chapter on the consular cousins about what happened to them. Interesting outcomes. As I said, we lived three or four houses away from the Abbey Vicarage, and that row of houses, I think they were all Levantines living. I think 80% of the people living in a street of 200 or 300 meters were Levantines. This is where I learned to ride. Maggie Jolly is the half-sister of Lucien Arcas, and Maggie is still in Esmer. I think my brother saw her only 3 weeks ago. And then I put quite a few pages on what Guido, my friend Guido Isidoro, used to talk about the Fra Giacomos to which he was related, and to his and to the life in Cordelio, and also the 1922 events, their version of what happened. Under E for Ephesus, I relate my stay with the Catholic monks each summer, and there's a picture of my mother in the center with Sir Louise, I think, on her flat, Sister Louise, her brother on her right-hand side, and Sir Marguerite, the one, the short-sighted lady, sister on the right-hand side.
You had to go. I had to run. I'm so sorry, but my train got cancelled, so to get back to England,
thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're nearly finished.
Okay. Anyway, I'm sorry to miss
Thank you.
So we only have a couple of slides. I think we're doing all right with time. For me, one word that stayed with me is when I heard my grandmother on her deathbed, after she was given the last rites, she smiled and said to us, Erkete, which means it means it's coming. And she said that a few times, but quite peacefully, and then she expired. And then after that, whenever I faced death, and it happened to me several times, I remember her. And I do not fear anymore, because I remember her face as she was dying. She was so peaceful and almost welcoming death. So that was something that impressed me. I mentioned before this Fair of Izmir, and in it I tell you about how we all used to have impressive, very impressive national pavilions, and how myself and my uncle, we will go and visit almost every other pavilion, as we did work for the British Consulate General by then. And it was interesting to witness in a nice, quiet, beautiful city how the USA and the USSR were fighting to get the favors of the Turks. It was so important. And you may remember, some of you, about the American bases in Turkey and how important it was to keep those bases going in the Cold War. And it's in one of those years or occasions of the Izmir Fair that I thought I would want to have the job of a press consul that we have for John Hyde. I said, I want John Hyde's job. That's what I want to do. I don't want to be a journalist or anything. And that's how I started my adult life. And my father's writings ended on page 238, and so did mine. These are photographs of my father with his shooting companions. The center photo shows a whole bag and birds and that they've been shooting, and a wild boar. And the bottom photograph is another passion of the Smyrna people, the Levantines, was to go on picnics out in the hills and have a good time, frolicking probably. And as I finish this, of course, it happened that the Queen passed. I had finished previously by telling you what we did as a Honorary British Consul and myself as Vice Consul, but I put this remembering Her Late Majesty and how I still remember her coronation, 5th June 1953, and many years later in 1971, how she came to Smyrna, how my father and I engineered that she should come to Smyrna instead of visiting Bursa. She visited Istanbul, Ankara, and she was due to go to Bursa, and we said, no, we're going to get her to come to Izmir. And we diverted Britannia to come. You're from Bursa. You understand.
I know why.
So that completes my... I hope I haven't bored you. I'm sure Quentin is going to give the signal downstairs for some refreshments to arrive. And Philip, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, George. And it's... amongst us a living, the living memory of Smyrna and Izmir, and it's a huge privilege to have a direct access to the past, including things like the visit of Elizabeth II, when I believe a Levantine lady danced with Prince Philip and said, I remember dancing here with your father, Prince Andrew of Greece, in 1920 or something.
Well, that was an occasion when Philip had come by himself.
Ah.
But the Queen had not been there.
Ah.
He had come for the wild life.
Wild
life.
What year is that?
It would have been in 1965 possibly. It needs investigating because I can't remember. I think he had come with Churchill on Onassis Hill. But it needs certifying, it needs checking.
So much needs.
Well, one thing, excuse me, talking of Philip, we had a reception on the Britannia, and we had stipulated, please, no dinner jackets. This is a private party that the Queen is inviting us to for cocktails. No number five uniforms, just arrive as, you know, to have a good time. But Levantine and Turkish ladies, as they are, being what they were, they dressed in their most beautiful dresses with all their parures and jewelry. So Philip could not contain himself and said, are you going to another party?
Well, thank you very much. And I want to start the questions with some questions of my own. Now, when you were growing up, did people talk a lot about the fire?
Yes.
And did you ever hear Turks blame Mustafa Kemal and the Turks for the fire?
Did I hear Turks blame? Well, as I did not mix that much with Turks, it's what our teachers at school would have told us, because we have French teachers and Turkish teachers, and interestingly, we had history being in French, which was mostly the French history of France and the colonies and whatever. And the history was the Turkish teachers. And I mentioned in several passages how the Turkish teachers used to teach us Turkish history and how they all came from Central Asia, Türkler, Anadolu, Orta Asya. And so
it was
sanitized. It was sanitized. You remember Batur, and so on.
Yeah.
And these Turks were of descendants of various tribes of Turks as well, but they had to follow a certain line of what they were going to teach and what they were going to say. But they basically, about the fire, they said that it was an accident. They didn't blame the Greeks. No.
Oh.
And they did not. Some said that it had happened in the Armenian Quarter, which is plausible, because they had sought refuge in a church and settled the fire. I think it was a serious. Reading my father's description, and he was only a boy, but he just managed to peep in the ship to look over. He mentioned that there were several fires, not just one single fire.
Because they started it at different times. Anyway, it was while the city was under Turkish military control.
At that moment, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you were growing up, were there any Greeks still in Smyrna?
There were Greeks who were not Orthodox.
Greek Catholics.
There were Greek Catholics.
Like Lucia Argos.
Yeah, for instance. Yeah. There were a couple that had come from Istanbul, but they were Orthodox, but there were very, very few. For some reason, I think they had Turkish nationality.
Mm-hmm.
And they managed to come, but there were very few. I remember going, my grandmother taking me to the Greek Orthodox Church, which we visited together, if you remember, the old Dutch chapel.
Yeah. And there was still a Greek Orthodox Church.
Yeah, yeah.
A functioning church.
As I was growing, yes. We had the Greek... I mentioned the English, the Anglican priest, but there was also a Greek priest whom I learned to say, O Patir, Kalimeras Patir, as he went past our home, and he was wearing a kocho, and he had a family. But yes, under the aegis of the Greek consulate, yes.
Thank you so much. Now, I'm sure there are more questions from the floor. Yes, over there. Okay, yes. Can you say your names?
My name is Helene.
Yes.
Yeah, and I would like to understand it must be quite traumatic, of course, to leave for Malta already.
Yes.
But what drew them back?
Because they considered Smyrna as their home.
Yeah.
And then they found that their home had changed the landlord. but they thought that better go to the devil you know than to the devil you don't know.
Yeah.
And also, I think, remembering what my grandmother used to say, that although she spoke Maltese, the Maltese, well, as there were refugees in Malta, the Maltese did not recognize them as Maltese. They said, oh, the Greeks have arrived. And interestingly, I think he mentioned this, but in case it's not mentioned in the book, because his family was the last one to be evacuated, others had left on the main in a hospital ship a few days before. This was a coal bunker, a coal ship that had not finished unloading, and so everything was black with soot, with coal. So when they landed, my father's family landed, the Maltese started shouting, oh, they brought Negroes. Where have they brought the Negroes from? And then they had to be hosed down and washed and so on. Yes.
Always this thing of Levantines not really being accepted in the home country. When Italians were thrown out of Turkey in 1911, the Italians in Naples all said, "Vengono I Turchi."
Mamma I Turchi.
Now, another question. Yes?
Hi, Sasha, my name.
Hi, Sasha.
When you talk about the passion for hunting, was that after the fire, or when always loved it?
No, my father was in the 30s, as he was old enough to...
And in the 20s?
I got my first gun when I was 8.
There were no butchers in Smyrna.
Well, there were. Before the fire, there were plenty of butchers.
Oh, okay, so it was a post-fire.
Oh, yes, yes. And then, funny enough, after the fire, my grandfather, Georgie, the grocer, and his son, Uncle Anthony, they built themselves, or had somebody build a smoker. And they used to smoke wild boar and the pigs that were raised in secret by the Sirais and so on, the French.
The passion for hunting was universal in Europe and the Ottoman Empire before the First World War. And Anatolia had such a variety of game, and I saw some of the Whittle's photographs of shooting expeditions. It was a paradise for anybody who liked hunting.
Yes, in fact, he mentions in this chapter, my father mentions the various groups or clans, the clans from Cordelio, Pasciopera, it was Les Jeunes de Kashiaka, it was Les Anciens de Bournava, it was each one, they had all these clans, they used to get together sometimes and come back with an enormous amount of meat, which would be distributed to the orphanages that were still existing. And then the Turk said, no, there are no more Christian orphanages, you have to go. And so I also mentioned all these orphanages and a couple of people who went to orphanages, to the orphanage, and how they succeeded. In one particular, I mentioned Marius Pascal. I think I devoted two or three pages on Marius and how he had grown up in an orphanage and what he achieved in Turkey as a Turkish guide.
Any more questions? Yes, George.
Hi, George.
George.
Hi, George. Maybe as a little bit of an epilogue, tell us about when your parents came to England. Did they miss Smyrna, or did they feel like?
My mother did.
Yeah.
My mother did. It's the climate that got her. She used to write to her friends on les nuages entre dans mon salon. You know, it seems that the clouds are entering my living room. She didn't like it very much, but she loved having the grandchildren. She Josh's mommy and Josh's uncle. You know, family.
Your mom was a very warm lady.
Any more questions? Yes, over there.
So when did your parents move to the UK or London, and why?
Why? Because my father was fed up being the honorary British consul. It was becoming very expensive. I will deal with all this in my next book. I will explain how costly it had become, because we have an influx of Turkish foreign tourists, British tourists, many of them getting themselves shot or getting into trouble and so on, and we could not charge the high fees of the Foreign Office to other people. So my father started spending his own money to rescue British people and so on. So he said, it's about time to go. Also, apocryphally, we had a new ambassador, and Sir Roderick Saddle, who was the last Levantine ambassador to Ankara, had finished his term and he was leaving, and he said to my father, we're going to have socialists in London, and they'll be sending socialist ambassadors. I don't know if you want to stay. So he kind of sort of encouraged him to. Shall I go and see where?
Yes. Churisburg? And any more questions?
Tell me the Levantines are protesting.
Yes.
Yeah, I read somewhere that, you know, after the fire, especially the Levantines, that there was a huge kind of, how should I say, gap in terms of trade, you know, like the people in Britain, they weren't even able to find suppliers because they had many people had to leave and they were economically
Yes.
When you came back from Malta, did you feel that? I mean, what was it?
Well, when my
what was
parents
the observation in terms of economy and the impact of economy?
Yes. Well, the Turks did not, the few Turks that there were, and there were quite rich people there, but they had their own, they were trading with Turks. And they had no language, no, few had foreign languages. So it was left to mediocrely educate people like my father and others, who hadn't had a chance of having a proper good education, but still good enough, and they were clever enough to educate themselves to perform all the jobs for the trade. So he describes with great details there how the Catholics that were left, Levantines, and the Jews managed to get all the jobs in the banks, and they were keeping the trade going. But he also describes how even the telegraph office was operated still by British people, like the clerk. So he described how Mr. Clerk guided my father into how to follow a career, because he used to go and send telegrams to the foreign companies and said, you're an intelligent boy, why don't you go and follow this and follow up that? This is a good company, go and apply to them. And he guided him. So they were helping each other. So they kept, basically, they sustained the economy of Smyrna, the export, from the 1930s to the 50s or 60s. Even in the 70s, when I got my, I was waiting for the foreign office to approve me, I worked as a travel agent. And in the travel business, many, many of us, like the Katoli Travel Agency and so on, were Levantines. And we had the tourism business running. And very nice was good. Yeah, it was a nice...
Any more questions? Yes, over there.
Do you know that Grandpa had written his account, or did you find it?
After he died.
After.
He found it. You know, I showed you the briefcase he left. The leather briefcase I showed you.
Right.
I found his word of paper, and he used to write on anything he could find. As soon as he had an idea, he used to write. But he used to write, started writing these things in 1960s. Whenever he was, he would write something, and he would put it all together, and he started writing in his tiny, tiny, minuscule handwriting.
In English, or?
In English. But thinking, and that's in the opening chapter of the book, I say, you will find that my father's English is written in English, but his thinking is in French, or Greek, or Italian. And in places I translate for the reader what he actually meant.
There's something you once said to me that you found leaving Smyrna and visiting Italy, say, in the 1950s, Smyrna seemed more modern than many bits of Italy.
Absolutely, yes. And Athens. More modern than Athens.
More modern
and bits
than
of
Athens.
Italy, yes.
You see, at that time, I think, in Italy, you had interesting theatres. You had the Grand Hotel.
Yeah.
And everybody, wealthy people, it was like Alexandria, possibly better.
Yes.
And then people really took part and showed off. But it was all Western, it wasn't the type.
Yes, and it's amazing, that's the thing, it's amazing how modern the Turks were in my childhood. And we see photographs and so on.
They used to wear dinner jackets and
the ladies
were from the Balkans, weren't they?
Yes, many of them were, yeah. And we had fantastic nightclubs. I spent quite a bit of describing a bit our nightclubs and theatres.
Exactly.
And fantastic, in the summer, an open-air theatre in the fairgrounds, translating from Greek classics into Turkish. Troops coming from Istanbul and famous Mezent Senar and so many famous singers and actors, actresses.
Actually, I have a question about that, because, you know, like, when I see about Smyrna, I always hear this cosmopolitan kind of, like an adjective, you know?
Yes,
like, yes. And it's interesting, you know, how would you compare it to Constantinople? Because Constantinople is, I think, as a percentage of minorities, never reached that kind of high level of Smyrna in a way.
Yes. It was funny, I described when we went to Constantinople on visits, Greek was spoken widely and French in the hotels, Theropolis, we all speak French in there. But the people, it was a completely different culture than the Smyrna Levantine culture. This is something, Theodosia, that when we have a meeting with Constantinopolitans in UK, maybe at that gathering, we might start analyzing. I already...
Yes.
We had a good conversation with your chairman before he went to Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And he was discovering things that he was not aware of.
And for example?
I don't know, the way of thinking, the fashions, the philosophy, the business acumen. Our business acumen was very, I think, different.
In Smyrna.
In Smyrna.
Yeah.
Because you went, you lived in Istanbul, you went to school in Istanbul, Hélène went to Istanbul, Joyce, both the Saliba sisters lived in Istanbul. Did you find Istanbul Christians were different from Smyrna Christians?
Like you, we always lived with the Christian community. So to us, it was very much the Greeks, the Italians, and the French. And wherever we went, it was the same kind of community.
Yes.
But to me, personally, I felt, even that I was born in Izmir, Izmir was more, the Italian, the Greek, to me was more Greek-based.
Uh-huh.
Where in Istanbul, there was more a mixture of it.
And there was the Armenians as well.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a bigger place as well compared to
Izmir.
But Izmir felt like more like a family.
Yes.
You know, everybody knew everybody. Yes. Where in Istanbul they were more spread and there was less of them.
But I think one of the important points here, Izmir, with that railway, which was built by the Greeks, the Hasanjak railway station, was basically to improve the trade of cotton, the raisins, the apricots.
Yes.
So you had big English companies there, you had French
buyers. Oh yes, the buyers. We had all
the
buyers.
So it was more of a commercial centre. Possibly more than Istanbul. And that's why it allowed for this grand light by the waterfront. And
We had the continuous injection of Western, whether it's American or Canadian or Northern European. Whereas Istanbul didn't have so much.
I'm not 100% sure, but I feel like I read somewhere that at one point the economy in Smyrna was bigger than Constantinople.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. And I haven't analyzed. I have the reports from the French consulate general in Smyrna describing and comparing the trade and giving the figures.
But it wasn't only trade on dried fruits and cotton, there was also minerals.
And opium.
Yeah.
And opium,
Carpets.
Carpets, yes. The Oriental Carpet Company.
Tobacco.
Well, thank you so much, George. Really fascinating. We look forward to the next book.